It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, here today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later in the program, we'll try and solve the mystery of how a 10-foot-tall bronze statue went missing in Milwaukee. That's the subject of today's Curious Wisconsin segment.
But first, President Obama announced new proposals today aimed at making colleges more accountable and affordable by rating them and ultimately linking those ratings to financial aid.
Now, the president has said that making college affordable is a personal mission, as he's pledged to shake up the current system. But the question is, will Congress ultimately side with him?
Joining us to talk about the president's plan is Colleen McCain-Nelson. She's the White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and she's currently traveling with the president. Colleen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the crux of this new plan is the creating of a rating systems for colleges. Tell me what you know about how that will work.
Well, it's a kind of a brand new idea. The president wants to create a rating system. He wants to collect all sorts of data looking at how good of a value each college is. What are the graduation rates? What are the transfer rates? Do they get disadvantaged students to graduate? How much do graduates earn after they leave college? He wants to use a wide range of data sets to determine how good a value each college is. And then he eventually wants to ask Congress to tie those ratings to the allocation of financial aid, so that if you get a good rating, you will get more access to financial aid. Students who go to your schools will be able to get larger Pell Grants and better interest rates on loans.
Now, a good rating would mean what? That your college doesn't cost a ton of money and that its graduates do relatively well?
Well, the president keeps using the word value, and so a number of different things would go into assessing that. And affordability is certainly one aspect of that. Getting students to graduate is another aspect of that. The president points out that right now, colleges essentially just get money largely based on how many students they enroll, and there's not as much follow-up to consider, are these students that are getting this money, are they actually completing college, are they graduating, are they learning what they need to learn and getting good jobs afterwards? So he wants to, he says, hold colleges more accountable for actually educating students and getting good results. But as many people have pointed out today, the devil will be in the details, and exactly how the rating system works remains to be seen because it's yet to be developed.
Now, some of these data points that he's talking about including, they're not that contentious. Some of the information is out there already, but some of them are things that are new, such as, I think, how much graduates might earn afterward. Which ones are contentious?
Right. Well, that certainly is a question mark, how much graduates will earn. And higher education experts have pointed out that not all of this data is collected at this moment and may not be readily available. So there are certainly a lot of data sets that exist that would be available immediately to create this rating system, but questions remain about how this other data would be collected, where it would come from, how you would track some of these things. And so so everyone is still kind of assessing how this might work, and there are a lot of unanswered questions.
Do you have a sense about why President Obama is introducing this plan right now?
Well, that's an excellent question. He certainly has a lot of other issues on his plate at the moment. You know, he wants to get immigration reform passed. He needs to get people to sign up for his new health care law. He has a lot going on in the world, in Syria and Egypt and other places. But the White House says that the president is speaking honestly when he says this really is a personal mission. He thinks this is very important, and he wants to start the process now. And I think one could argue that the president has a limited window of opportunity in his second term and needs to get things done relatively quickly. So knowing that Congress doesn't get a lot of things done relatively quickly, I think he wanted to put this idea out there as soon as he could.
What's the reaction been so far?
Well, the reaction has been mixed so far. Not surprisingly, some Republicans on Capitol Hill already have come out against the plan and have said, you know, that the answer is not the answer to every problem is not to give more power to Washington bureaucrats. among colleges and universities and higher education experts, we've heard some praise for the president encouraging innovation and challenging colleges to get good results. But they've also raised some questions, and some have expressed some opposition, particularly on the front of where this data will come from, how it will be collected.
Now, one thing that's important to the president is that tuition for colleges gets tapered off a little bit. He seems to feel that it's been running away. And so it sounds like he's got some bits of this proposal that's urging colleges to experiment with new ways of reducing costs. Did he give any details about what that might look like?
Right. A couple ideas that he offered up were creating more accelerated three-year degree programs, saying that colleges should focus more on what students are learning and not how many hours they're actually spending in the classroom. He also wants to see more innovation with online classes, particularly large online classes that are free and widely available to huge numbers of people. And he really wants colleges to take some chances and try some new things and to encourage competition among colleges. And so he's hopeful that if he can kind of peel away some of the regulations that might have been standing in the way of innovation, that some new ideas will come forward and help ultimately make college more affordable.
Now, you said that this is personal for President Obama. Do you have a sense about why that is and why it matters so much?
I think part of it is this summer he has really turned his focus to the middle class. He's been on a tour across the country rolling out a series of proposals, all of which have been focused on improving life for the middle class. And so this is part of that rollout of a wide range of proposals. But also, President Obama talks a lot about the student loans that both he and wife Michelle Obama took out to go to college and then to go to grad school. And he notes that they were still paying off their loans when they were in their 40s, right up until the time that he was running for the U.S. Senate. And he said, you know, we were still paying our loans at a time when we should have been saving for college for our daughters, not still paying off our own education from years and years ago.
Do you have a sense about, you know, we talked a little bit about how Congress responded, what some Republicans have said, about just people in the audience, general people on the street, if they think this is a good idea?
Well, I think that it's hard to argue that making college affordable is a good idea. There's strong support for that, and so I think that this is an issue that gets really high ratings among voters, and they will tell you that they're interested in seeing what the president could do to make that happen. Republicans, of course, who might oppose the president's plan in the details, also will say that they too want to make college more affordable. So I guess it comes down to the details. I think there's a wide agreement that a lot of families simply can't afford to send their kids to college and that something should be done about that. But how to accomplish that remains the sticking point when you delve deeper into the conversation. But the president's message today is he says that college should be an imperative and not a luxury.
Now, as you talked about, there is a lot on President Obama's docket in the second term. How does this fit in priority-wise?
Well, I think the White House would say that this is a key priority and that that the economy is their number one priority, and this kind of falls under the umbrella of improving the economy, making life better for the middle class. And so it's a large umbrella that encompasses a number of different things, focused on job creation, focused on housing proposals, focused on higher education. And so I think they would shy away from putting these in rank order. But their message this summer has been that the economy is the focus and that the president wants to see the middle class succeed and make it possible for people to be a little more mobile economically.
All right. Well, Colleen, thank you so much for joining us, and I'll let you get back to writing about the president.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
That was Colleen McKay-Nelson, a White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and she's currently traveling with the president.
Coming up next, it is Curious Wisconsin. We'll be exploring how a 10-foot-tall bronze statue disappeared from Milwaukee and where it might be now. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We recently came across an article in Urban Milwaukee about the disappearance of a 10-foot-tall statue named Germania. And that is going to be the subject of today's Curious Wisconsin segment.
The statue was on the Germania building at 2nd and Wells in downtown Milwaukee from 1896 until it was removed secretly in the night.
That was back in 1918, and that really is where the mystery starts. Brian Jacobson joins us now to talk about the disappearance and what happened after that. He's a freelance writer in Milwaukee. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you along. I think this is a terrific story. And how did you come across it?
Well, I have to tell you that the germ for the story really started about 6 years ago. And it was because I was looking at a lot of old postcards of Milwaukee. And I would come across ones that had really fantastic fountains and monuments. And I'd be like, well, wait a minute. I know that park. Where is that elk statue? And I finally decided on five different items that I wanted to try and find. And out of those, I managed to find the other four, and the fifth one was the Germania statue. And I just could not find it and could not find it, so I sort of just gave up on the idea. And it wasn't until recently that I decided to just sit down a couple of times with Russell Zimmerman, who did the most extensive research on the subject for the new building's owners in 1981, and try and use the internet to, you know, use all those new resources to see if there was maybe further things that I could find.
Boy, nothing like a good mystery to really get you fired up, huh?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So take us back to when the building that the Germania statue was on. Take us back kind of to that time in Milwaukee's history. Of course, a lot of German history there, if you think of Schlitz, Pabst, and I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. Talk a little bit about that building and then the statue that sort of graced it.
Sure. Well, the building itself was, sort of the culmination of going from rags to riches for George Brumder. In the Brumder family, George was the 15th out of 16 kids. He came over to America when he was 18 to see his sister get married to a Lutheran minister, and he decided to stay in Wisconsin and work as a farmer for a while, and then he laid down the tracks for the streetcars here in Milwaukee. And he finally opened up a bookshop and met his wife at Grace Lutheran Church, and they started doing book selling and also printing, especially of German books and hymnals and Bibles. And so they became very rich within a very short period of time, enough so that he was able to build the tallest office building in Milwaukee at the time, this neoclassical Beaux-Arts structure. Eight stories tall. At the time, in 1896, it was like a lot of the other buildings, had very German features. This time, there's these giant green copper domes on top of the building that look like Kaiser helmets. And, for 20, 25 years, it was the pride and joy of a major population here in Milwaukee. And he had commissioned, when it was built, Carl Keynes, who was a sculptor that made a lot of famous statues, to make an exact replica of a monument that's over in Germany, and that was the Germania statue. And it, for the 25 years, it was a pride and joy, and it wasn't until World War I that it became a problem.
And it became a problem, of course, because of the American entrance into World War I and anti-German sentiment, not just in Milwaukee, but anywhere there was anything remotely German. You know, street names were changing, old German names were falling by the wayside, and right here in Milwaukee, you've got this great big statue just sort of sitting there, and it made some people unhappy.
That's right. Like a lot of other cities, like you said, you know, street names changed and the language itself kind of was spoken in alleyways to each other during that short time period. And there was a Canadian, a British war recruiting officer that had his office right across the street from it. And he just had to look at it every day. And he was so upset by it that he was keep going to the Milwaukee Journal and saying, that's a terrible, terrible thing in this town, and we have to take it away. And so the Brumders, by that time George had passed away, and his son Suns had taken over, and William C. Brumder had managed to go to UW, Wisconsin College, and was on the first football team, and he was a Republican. He was very American, and he agreed that, you know, for the sake of the business, they would get rid of the statue. And so that's where he took a family friend, Cyril Kolnick, who was a very famous ironwork artist here in Milwaukee, him and his crew in the middle of the night to take the statue down and hide it. And unbeknownst to everybody, he hid it in his studio for the next 20 years.
So it sat in his studio for an awfully long time, and he knew it was there, obviously. And then since then, it sort of it disappears and then surfaces every so often. Can you kind of take us through the next few decades?
Sure. Well, after it disappeared after World War I, nobody just ever talked about it again in the newspapers or anywhere. And it sat in the corner collecting the dust from the forges where they were making the ironwork in the shop. He had a very famous little shop on 8th and Kilbourne, which is where MacArthur Square Park is now. And in 1936, one of the Milwaukee Journal columnists wrote a story where he imagined going over there in the middle of the night and the statue coming to life. And he had a conversation with a lady, and she was this very haughty lady, and she would ask about politics and things that were going on. And then the sun came up, and she turned back into a statue. And it was the first time that anybody had said, oh, that's where she is. And, you know, instead of hauling her out the next couple of years, you know, and being anti-German was popular again because with the rise of Hitler and then the entrance into World War II came along. But before that, in 1940, she was borrowed out for the first time ever to a convention that was happening at the Milwaukee Auditorium. But afterwards, she was laid down in the basement horizontally and then just forgotten about for another couple of years.
But then all of a sudden, there was that big scrap drive during World War II where people were looking for any kind of metal they could get. And here you've got 3 tons worth of metal mm-hmm. there. There's some speculation that she wound up in the scrap heap.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the conclusion that I don't necessarily spell out in the article, but that's what I pretty much fear happened to her because this guy, W.E. Simons, who ended up becoming this regional director for Wisconsin and just made a very rapid rise for how successful he was in getting scrap metal for the war effort, wanted the statue. And then he was told by Washington, stop melting everything down. You're being silly.
Because he was melting down anything of historic value, art, it really didn't matter. If it was metal, it was going to the war, right?
Yeah, he convinced an entire community to melt down their pedestrian bridge that went over a river.
He was good at what he did. We have to give him that.
He was. But he was not successful, supposedly, in this mark. By this time, Cyril Kolnick was in poor straits. You know, for such a famous and wonderful artist, he was having a hard time because the county government had taken his shop because they wanted the land, and his wife dies, and he has to move with his daughter into this little tiny space. And so he doesn't have the means to take her back, and he also realizes it's a piece of art. And he shouldn't just be taking $700 for something that was, you know, cost $7,500 to make back in 1896. It was probably worth $10,000, you know, or more in World War II. And so, you know, that's the last anybody ever heard of it. It was in this article that said Washington told W.E. Simons stop melting things down. And Kolnick said that he would take an offer for the statue, but not for what the scrap dealers were offering.
So after all of your research, after everything, after every internet rock you could turn over, you've pretty much come to the conclusion that she was turned into a tank or bullets or something.
Yeah, Russ Zimmerman told me a story that he never wrote about in his article, and that's because it's all fourth-hand rumor, which is all we have to go on now, in which a woman who was a secretary that worked at the auditorium and just randomly told one of the docents at the Germania building that would show people around, she's like, yes, I worked at the auditorium. It was so sad to see her arm hanging out of the end of a gondola cart, which kind of gives you the conclusion that they broke her apart.
Wow, what a great story. So you're going to be keeping your eyes open, though. I mean, she still could turn up someplace, although it's hard to hide something like that.
Yeah, I went into crazy detail, and I have to give my respect to Bruce Murphy for helping me turn this into a real story for Urban Milwaukee, because I just put every bit of detail into the original versions. And I did crazy research that Russ had never done out on Pine Lake, where a lot of the Brumners moved after World War II.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave that mystery right there. Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. All right. Thank you.
Brian Jacobson is a freelance writer in Milwaukee.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk about the importance of having a national conversation about depression and how we can talk honestly about the subject.
Meanwhile, tomatoes are all over farmers' markets and in your gardens right now. We'll be talking with a food writer about making some great summer salsas.
And we'll get a roundup of the top state news stories with WPR news guy Noah Ovshinsky.
That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. In 2012, the United States ranked 17th among developed countries for education, according to an education firm called Pearson.
Our next guest wanted to know what we could learn from the world's leaders in education, and so she tracked exchange students who went to school in high-ranking countries and wrote a book about what she found called The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way.
And Amanda Ripley, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you were initially reluctant to start writing about education. What changed your mind?
You know, I had this inaccurate, as it turns out, belief that education was an impossible problem to solve, that it was like, you know, poverty or homelessness, and I couldn't see a way to really get your hands around it. But it turned out to be much, much more interesting than I realized.
Well, one of the things that got you going was visiting classrooms and getting a sense of exactly where the U.S. was positioned on education. Can you give us a sense of where the U.S. is on the national stage?
Sure. You know, we hear these headlines about how we're underperforming compared to countries around the world. And the truth is a little more complicated, but still really interesting. In reading, American kids do pretty well compared to kids around the world. Where we really seem to drop off is in math and science, and it gets worse as kids get older. The other problem we have is that, you know, in this country, if you're born into a low-income family, it's getting harder and harder to get a good education, and that's not true in some other countries. So, you know, the world is big, the country is big, there's a lot of things going on. It's hard to make sweeping generalizations, but nothing I heard about the explanations for why this was so really added up. So I wanted to really spend some time focusing on these countries and understanding not just where they are now, but how they got that way.
Now, as you delved into this, it sounds like there was a lot of movement in educational performance around the world, countries shooting up or countries sinking down, and then there was the United States.
Right. This is really surprising. If you look at how countries and kids perform over time, the U.S. is pretty stagnant with some slight improvement over the past 60 years or so, but that's the exception. Most countries have changed a lot for better and for worse over that time period, with some countries really dramatically improving. I mean, in 1950, only 10% of kids in Finland even graduated from high school, and now they've got a better high school graduation rate than we do, and they're educating virtually all their kids to really high levels of critical thinking.
Yeah, so Finland seems like it's a rock star in education right now. They're at the top of the heap. Who else is out there who's doing really well?
The countries, some of which are predictable, that you expect to hear, Korea, Singapore, Japan, but also Canada is a surprising top performer. And I say surprising because, you know, it's really not that different from the U.S. in some ways, particularly that they don't really have a federally organized education system. It's all very local and provincial. And they have a relatively high amount of child poverty like we do and immigration intake as well.
Well, it's interesting what you say about poverty, because usually that's the thing people point to when they talk about why the United States is not keeping pace in education. They talk about poverty. They say, hey, we've got something like a 20% poverty rate, and that's the excuse. Does that hold up to you?
You know, I kind of think of this as like a chemical equation. There's definitely a lot of things that interact. Poverty is part of why we are where we are, but again, it's not as much of an explanation as we tend to think it is. One great counterexample to get at this is Norway. Norway shares a border with Finland. This is a very affluent country with less than 6% child poverty, one of the lowest rates in the world. They have universal health care. So you'd think, what could be wrong? But in Norway, teenagers are performing at or below the rate of U.S. teenagers on education, despite the fact that they're one of very few countries to spend even more than we do per student. So, you know, poverty, again, is part of the equation. It makes everything harder, harder to learn, harder to teach. But it is not a full explanation for why, for example, even our richest kids perform 18th in the world in math compared to affluent kids around the world.
Well, let's talk about, you know, the bulk of your book. You got your lessons from these kids themselves who went as exchange students to some of these high-performing countries. Tell us about the kids and where they went.
Yeah, these kids were remarkable guides. In fact, I started out, I just thought they'd be part of the book as a way to make it more interesting, and they were really became the main focus and purpose of the book. One was named Kim, and she was just 15 years old, and she lived in rural Oklahoma and had never left the U.S., but really had a desire to get out of her town and see the world. And so when she read that Finland had some of the smartest kids in the world and seemed like an interesting place, and she knew nothing about it, she told her mom she wanted to go there on a study abroad program for a year. And her mom was not so keen on the idea, but she told her if she could raise the $10,000 she needed by herself, she could go. So off she goes from rural Oklahoma to rural Finland after a year-long fundraising quest, and ends up in a host family in Pietarsaari, Finland.
And what did she find when she started going to school?
Well, she was a little surprised the first time she saw the school because it, you know, it was kind of dingy on the outside. There was a big clock outside that had clearly broken years ago, and it wasn't quite the, you know, Nordic nirvana that she had imagined and that we tend to read about. You know, when reporters go on official education junkets, they get taken by the Ministry of Education to the most beautiful, perfect schools, just as we do when reporters come here. So, you know, to see a regular school in a rural part of Finland, it doesn't look exactly the way you might expect. And in fact, all these kids noticed that right away, that the facilities were not so great compared to their schools back in the U.S., and there was very little technology in the classroom, even in countries that are, you know, pretty wired digitally otherwise, like Korea and Finland. So, you know, that's a difference right there, that even when I surveyed hundreds of exchange students, they all agreed that, you know, they saw way more technology in their U.S. schools than they did back home.
Yeah, it's not what you think, is it? You think there would be a lot of technology, because that's what we keep hearing about, that you need to be up on technology.
Right. That will somehow save the day. But it does seem to be an American impulse to invest in stuff and shiny objects and gadgets over sometimes people.
Okay, so that's what the schools looked like. They looked sort of less beautiful and high-tech than we would have expected. But what about the instruction in Finland?
You know, it's funny because I went to classrooms, as did Kim in Finland, that were kind of, you know, unimpressive. Teaching was kind of boring and not that amazing. And so you don't always walk in and get blown away in any of these countries. I mean, I saw that everywhere. And I see that in the U.S., right? I see huge variation from classroom to classroom. One thing, though, that Kim did pick up on was how much kids seemed to buy into the premise of education. They seemed, even though they were normal in every other way, they were a lot like kids back in Oklahoma. You know, they went to parties, they complained about certain teachers, they texted when they were supposed to be listening in class. But they seemed to buy into the idea that school directly related to how interesting their lives would be as adults in a way that even the kids in her honors classes in Oklahoma did not. So that was very perplexing to her. Trying to figure out all year long, actually, what it was that made them care so much.
Do you know? Because that's such an intangible.
Yeah,
how to get
right.
people to buy into the system. I mean, how do you? Nobody knows how to do that, do they?
Right. And I don't think they always bought in. Like, I don't think if she'd gone there 50 years ago, she would have seen the same level of investment. But, you know, obviously there's a lot of things going on. But I came away from it and from talking to Kim and talking to people there and spending time with her, thinking that, you know, maybe kids in these countries take school more seriously because it is more serious. So it's maybe not as complicated as we think. Kids are really good at figuring out when something is bogus and when something is for real. So let me give you an example. In Finland, it's totally normal to get rejected from teacher training college. Very hard to get into. So it's very common to run into people who couldn't get into college to study education. So everyone knows that they only accept like the top 10% of people based on their equivalent of the SAT. And so from the beginning, the kids know that their teachers are some of the best educated, most accomplished people in the country. And that level of prestige really does filter down to the kids in ways I didn't expect.
Wow. And so what about the teacher pay? Because that's something we hear a lot about in the United States is, you know, should teachers be paid more? Or should they be paid according to the performance of their students? How does that stack up in Finland?
You know, teachers in Finland are paid more on average than teachers in the U.S. It's not wildly more, but it is closer to the average for what professionals make in that country. And so that's where we get a disconnect is, you know, there's a lot of people who make a lot of money in the United States, and there's a huge variance based on your profession. So clearly the U.S. is underpaying its teachers compared to developed countries around the world, but not by a lot, not by an astronomical amount. And we know that all around the world, past a certain baseline, paying teachers doesn't necessarily improve the system the way we think it might. So just very quickly, Spain pays its teachers more than any country in the world, but Spain does not have impressive education results for other reasons.
Hmm.
You know, it's a complicated kind of stew, and salary is only one way to compensate people. I think prestige can be even more powerful, particularly for the kinds of people who go into teaching.
So then if they're not being paid that much, or, you know, they're getting paid well, but they're not getting paid an astronomical amount, why is there so much competition to be a teacher in Finland?
Well, it's an interesting thing. You know, once you make something hard to be a part of, it gets more enticing, right? And so that's part of it. Part of it is once you make something hard to be a part of, there's more trust in that profession. So, you know, Finland went through a period kind of like our No Child Left Behind moment where there were, you know, the teachers had to keep journal entries of what they did every hour, and there was like, you know, 700-page curriculums for what they had to follow, and national inspections of schools. But as they improved the teacher training process and other things and kind of raised the floor, they eventually were able to unwind a lot of those more kind of oppressive industrial age policies to get to a place where, you know, if all of your teachers are decently educated and pretty well trained, then you can get to a place where you can give them more autonomy. And that's also really appealing, maybe more appealing than an extra $2,000 or $3,000 would be.
Well, we're talking right now with Amanda Ripley. She's a reporter for Time Magazine and the author of the book we're discussing. It's called The Smartest Kids in the World.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. Why do you think America is lagging behind in education? Is there something here you think needs fixing? And what do you think we might be doing right? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Or you can also post on our Facebook page. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert with you on Central Time. And we're picking up again with Amanda Ripley, who wrote the book The Smartest Kids in the World, about how American schools compare with some of the biggest achievers in education on the world stage, places like Finland, South Korea, and Poland. And we're finding out what works and what we could learn here in America. And we'd love to know what you think. Why do you think America is lagging behind, or at least is stagnant in our educational achievement? And what do you think it's going to take to get us moving up those rankings again? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And I want to get to the phones, Amanda. But first, a word you use a lot when you're describing what brings these top-achieving countries together is rigor. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think, you know, rigor is a word that's thrown around a lot and doesn't necessarily mean anything. But, you know, in these systems, what I noticed is there was just a level of seriousness with which the whole idea of education was handled. And that means how you select teachers, how you train them, how you treat them once they're in the profession, but also what kinds of material your kids are learning and how seriously the parents as well take school and what form their involvement takes in education. Does it take the form of helping with school plays and field trips and sports, or does it take the form of helping kids learn math at home, you know, which is what we see in these really top-performing countries? So rigor, I think, means learning higher-order thinking, learning to solve problems you've never seen before, and really learning thing to learn. And that's something we know the kids are going to be doing their whole lives, given the kind of economy we are now dealing with.
Yeah, and just as a side note, in Poland, it sounds like they read the test scores out loud.
Yeah, and actually, most countries, there's a lot more transparency about how your peers are doing in school, and also a lot more failure. Now, this can have good effects or bad effects, depending on whether you're in, you know, Poland or France. You know, you don't want it to become humiliating, obviously, but it is really important for failure to be part of learning, for failure to be a good thing, for failure to be seen as an opportunity by kids. And I really get the sense that in too many U.S. schools, failure is seen, and families, by the way, failure is seen as, you know, a secret tragedy, like it means you're not good at something inherently, as opposed to, well, you need to get help, you need to work harder, and this is an opportunity. The only way you learn, actually, is by making mistakes.
All right, well, let's get to the phones. We've got lots of people waiting to talk to you, starting with Nancy in Green Bay. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an elementary school principal in Green Bay, in the Green Bay Area Public Schools, and I'm very proud to say that. And what we have seen over the past few years is a change, a real shift in professional development toward job-embedded professional development, giving teachers that time they need to work together to plan effective lessons. And I think that is having a very positive impact. What I think could still change would be a change needs to take place in society. Earlier, your guest said that in other countries, education is respected and taken very seriously. And I think that is something that still we still have a way to grow in that area. Mm-hmm. But I think some of the changes in accountability have been good. The punitive changes in accountability have not been so good.
All right, Nancy, thank you so much. I'm so glad you called with that perspective as a principal. And Amanda, what do you think about what Nancy had to say?
Yeah, you know, we know around the world that the really high-performing countries, teachers do have more time to plan and collaborate, just as your caller said. So I think that's a great point. Even though the school years and school days are often a bit longer than that in the U.S., there's more time for teachers, partly because of that, to plan and think ahead as opposed to always reacting. And that, again, is a sign of a truly serious professional job where these are hard jobs, and teachers have to be able to prepare and work together.
How much planning time does a teacher get in, you know, Poland or Finland?
You know, the amounts vary depending on the school and depending on the place. But I'd say, you know, on average, they probably get twice what an American teacher gets, particularly in Finland, less so in Poland. And there are different reasons for that. You know, believe it or not, class sizes around the world tend to be a little bit larger than that in the U.S. So when class sizes are larger, you can theoretically, if you have really highly trained, well-supported teachers, you can get great results, partly because they have more time.
All right. Well, thanks to Nancy. And let's move on to Jean in Reedsburg. Hi, Jean.
Hi. Am I on?
Yep, you are.
Yep. Okay, great. I am half Colombian, and I spent my seventh grade in Colombia, South America, going to school there. And school was always a very high priority for my dad, and it really reflected on the whole culture. These kids, from seventh grade, you were taking lecture notes and copying off the board. You went home and you recopied all your notes with diagrams using colors and everything to present to the teacher the next day. And the teacher's word was golden with these parents. There was no messing around. And these kids, there was a playtime after school. We went home and we're like, come on, let's go outside and play. And they're like, no, we have to study. I think there has to be a much better blend between extracurricular activities and actual studies, which are so important for what the majority of us end up doing. I mean, there's so many kids that go on to be sports heroes, and most of us end up in jobs.
All right. Well, thank you so much for telling us about your experience, Jean. And what does that make you think of, Amanda?
Well, you know, there are different ways to get to the top of the world. What you do want to find is a balance, right, as your caller noted, because there are a lot of kids all over the world in other countries, particularly in Asia, but also in parts of South America and Europe, who are just working incredibly hard, incredibly long hours, and are, I mean, it's not a very efficient or graceful way to get to the top. What you really want to do is invest in quality over quantity, right? So that you can have some time to play and some time to do other things. But, you know, if anything, the U.S. has definitely erred on the side of too much time to play, particularly in sports compared to other countries. So getting that balance right is a real challenge, but maintaining that focus on rigorous learning, I think, helps make those decisions and set those priorities.
Okay, I think we have time for one more very quick call. Maggie in Milwaukee, you're up.
Yes. Hello?
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. My experience in the field as a parent and as a teacher is that I feel that the testing is a big part of our cultural problem because it gives parents a numerical data that they don't necessarily see reflects their child, and it also gives teachers a way with which to be graded themselves, and that may not necessarily, and in fact it often doesn't reflect the teacher's performance nor the child's performance in the classroom.
Okay, thank you so much, Maggie. And Amanda, that's something we hear a lot, that the problem is standardized testing. How does standardized testing look in other countries?
Yeah, you know, every really high-performing education superpower in the world tests its kids. You know, there's no way to know how you're doing unless you're measuring progress along the way and figuring out who needs help and helping get that help to those students. That said, it's pretty clear that the U.S. has way more standardized tests that are not very smart. So again, here, quality over quantity would be a better use of funds and time. We do the same thing with homework, by the way. American kids do quite a bit of homework on average, but most of it's kind of silly. Most of it does not actually add value and is not very rigorous, much like the standardized tests.
I've only got about 30 seconds left for your answer, but are you hopeful, having done this, that America can start moving forward again?
Absolutely. I mean, I actually see the economic uncertainty that we're dealing with as an opportunity. And as 45 states move forward, hopefully, with Common Core standards, more rigorous standards for what kids should know and do, I'm very hopeful that we could definitely improve our system for all kids.
Well, Amanda, it's been interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Amanda Ripley. She's the author of The Smartest Kids in the World.
Coming up on Central Time, we take a look at how Wisconsinites view issues of crime and punishment. The news is coming up next. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.